The JDRF is an international organization that funds critical research for treatment and ultimately a cure for type 1 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is a life-threatening autoimmune disease that strikes both children and adults suddenly and changes life as they know it forever. It cannot be prevented and there is no cure, at least not yet. The 200-plus mile Reach the Beach Relay, comprised of four teams and 48 runners, recently raced across New Hampshire from the White Mountains to Hampton Beach over two non-stop days to raise money for JDRF and to help improve lives and ultimately find a cure. While the race is over, the fight against this disease continues. Please join us and help support our mission to raise money for JDRF and make a meaningful difference in the treatment and cure for type 1 diabetes. To donate, go to www.team.jdrf.org or go to our website at abovethebasement.com and click on the link on the Charitable Causes page. Above the Basement Boston Music and Conversation is recorded at beautiful Woods Hill Table Restaurant in West Concord, Massachusetts. Woods Hill Table owns a farm in Bath, New Hampshire, where they raise their own meat. They offer a full raw bar and fresh fish caught off the coast of Massachusetts, and they even harvest their own maple syrup and honey for use in the restaurant. Local farms supply all their vegetables and grains, and Chef Charlie Foster uses international cooking techniques to create fantastic, seasonally focused cuisine. Go to woodshilltable.com for reservations or call 978-369 6300.
You know, old 45's ruled my life. I still got my turntable. Don't miss a chance to reminisce about the old songs when I'm able. Now I grew up with a steady dose of 60s rhythm and blues. I come from a simple place with a few simple rules. You can ask the best songwriters, the ones who write the jewels. The greatest songs are simply what Hank Williams said. Three chords and the truth. Three chords and the truth. Hank Williams said three chords.
Hello everyone, this is Chuck Clow from Above the Basement, Boston Music and Conversation. You just heard Three Chords and the Truth by Bruce Marshall from his album Misspent Youth. Bruce holds a special place for our band, the Butler Frogs, as we all met at one of his popular open mics several years ago. Bruce is a New England institution and has been in various bands, including Bruce Marshall and the Clue, and was a member of the Toy Caldwell Band. He has opened for Lynyrd Skynyrd, Charlie Daniels, the Outlaws, the Beach Boys, the list goes on and on. His current bands include the Bruce Marshall Group, as well as the Nor'easters, and he is also half of the Montgomery and Marshall acoustic duo with bluesman James Montgomery. So here's our conversation with Bruce, recorded at Woods Hill Table in Concord, Massachusetts. Bruce, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, guys. Great to be here.
It's a pleasure. And you were one of the first people we thought of when we decided to start doing something like this.
Because, oh, thank you.
Well, because you were the reason why the Butler Frogs got together. It was your open mic that you hosted.
That's true. Yeah, it has become kind of like Band Central, hasn't it?
That's right.
Yeah, I think I remember. It was like 6 years ago. So we started that
exactly.
about six, seven years ago.
But yeah, that's what I meant. Actually, we just talked to Dave G. Moore, and we talked about this, how we met at your open mic.
Yeah, and Tim Feeler, of course.
Tim Feeler was there.
The jail.
Yeah, and that's where I met Greg, and that's where I met Ron. We all met there.
That's amazing. Yeah, I love hearing that. It's just a community of people that have just branched out into so many. I mean, look at Tim Feeler just alone. He's in like eight bands.
I know.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a night off.
And I plucked him out of obscurity. We met together on a Moto Guzzi ride. We both ride Moto Guzzi Italian bikes, and somebody organized a Moto Guzzi ride we'd never met, and he said, Bruce Marshall, you have an open mic, right? I said, yeah, every Tuesday in Concord. He said, you know, I'm a stand-up bassist, but I haven't touched it in 6 years. And I said, you have to bring that thing down on a Tuesday night. You absolutely, he was kind of in retirement, you know.
Wow, you brought him out of retirement, and that's one of his, like, you know, signatures now is that stand-up bass.
Oh, absolutely. Yep, so he came right in and do you think I could be the house bass player for this? And I'm like, duh.
Yeah. And now he's in Main Street open mic jail. He's there forever. He's like, if he's not there, no one knows what to do.
Yeah. That's right. He tells the story in a very different way, Bruce, actually.
Oh, does he? Yeah. Well, that's why I gave him the nickname Machine.
The Machine. You know,
most people that come down do eventually get a nickname, and because he just never quits. I mean, yeah, he just...
great.
I love the way he plays.
No, he's fantastic, and he's a great guy, too.
Oh, super.
You have this quintessential story that you can even see in pictures of your black and white pictures of when you were a little boy, uh-huh. and you holding your... You're there, the little proud little boy in your pajamas.
Looking at my phonograph.
And you're looking at your records.
Yeah.
And then, you have something on your website. Where it's kind of like stages mm-hmm. of like, you got the little boy with the record player, and then with like his first guitar, and right. his first little band, and it kind of progressed from there. So you are right. you're a lifer. I mean, one of those real old school lifers who, you know, grew up influenced by the Beatles and
a musical family, parents that were, you know, mm-hmm. we were taught harmony at a young age. You know, they sung in the chorus and I mean, the choir, and I was the only unschooled musician in my family because I'm a guitar player.
Right. <yeah. laughs>
You know, now there's finally schools for those.
I'm not a keyboard player like Ron, you know. But yeah, so
although I did see you play keyboard in a couple of YouTube videos.
Though. Yes, I did play keys in the Toy Caldwell band.
Right,
willed my way into the band when they told me we love your voice, we'd hire you in a heartbeat if you were only a keyboard player. And I said, I am a keyboard player. And so I became one in about a month and learned all their stuff. And
right, right.
Well, they bought it.
Anyway, sorry, but you were saying about the schooling and your parents.
Yeah, yeah. My sister was a, you know, child prodigy on piano at 7 years old, my older sister. And both my parents knew how to read music and, you know, were pretty schooled. My father played guitar and trumpet. My mother sang and played piano. And my sister Sally, the youngest in the family, is really, I call her the best singer in the family. She's just absolutely amazing.
Huh.
And like me, pretty much unschooled, tremendous singer, good guitar player. You know, she would have done a lot more if she had not settled down and had a couple of kids and had to get off the road. She was in my band back in the 90s. So, very lucky. And, of course, not to be cliche, but mm-hmm. seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, I was the right age. I was 9. You know, our parents let us stay up late. You know, I just remember just looking at them saying, oh, man, this is what I want to do right here.
But yeah, that is the age. You're right. You're young enough to have this sort of fantasy, but you're old enough to sort of have it impressionable and to remember it. Wow, that had been. Do you remember that?
Sort of being vividly.
Yeah,
absolutely vividly. I remember the songs they played, and I remember about a month later, my mother waking me up out of a dead sleep, shaking me and saying, "Bruce, come to the TV. There's another band on Ed Sullivan, and they sound just like the Beatles. You're gonna love it." And it was Jerry and the Pacemakers singing,
oh, really?
"Don't Let the Sun Get You Crying."
Wow.
And I just bought that hook, line, and sinker, too. Wow. You know?
I'm impressed. Your mom broke you up.
My mom knew. She said, "He even holds the guitar like John Lennon." You know, we were like, our parents knew everything about the Beatles after a while, you know. But, yeah, so a lot of guys my age say this, you know. That was a watershed moment, for sure. You know?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it was
life-changing.
It is cliche, but it's totally legit. I think everyone's just referencing your story. That's what it is. Everyone's like, oh, you know, Bruce Marshall's stories is much better than my story, so I'm just going to grab that one.
Now, did you play and sing or both with your family?
Yes.
Growing up?
Yeah. My vocals, I was a little self-conscious about my singing voice because my grandfather used to record us on his old reel-to-reel player. And you know how you always hate your own voice?
Yeah.
So
I hate Ron's voice. But
yeah.
But
so for years, I was like, okay. It wasn't until later, you know, when I started playing just out of high school where I actually got roped into being the lead singer of my first professional band. And it was just basically because I was the only one that could remember the words. You're the singer. You know how to sing all these tunes. For some reason, you remember all this stuff. I'm like, no. I wanted to be the rhythm guitar player in the back.
So, and then, you know, the funny thing is that now you play with David Cornier.
Knoyer, yeah,
a fantastic guitarist.
Yeah, Dave's been with me so long; it's awesome. I feel lucky that
he's so good. Yeah.
One guy stayed with me that long.
he is incredible,
and it's fun for me too because you know I consider myself in the band. I'm the front man. I'm the lead vocalist, and you know I'll cut loose on guitar here and there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fun for me because he does all the heavy lifting. So that when I do step out, people are like, "Oh, this guy plays too." You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I really like to let him shoulder that. Our thing too is the interplay between the two guitar players.
Yeah.
We do a lot of, we're influenced by Dickie and Dwayne and Derek, you know, and Warren. So
well, I saw something recently. I was watching where you were talking about Toy. I think he passed in
94. Yeah, 93, actually, yeah.
And you were talking about that moment, but you played and you dedicated a tune that he had written, and you I'm forgetting what the song was right now, but you and the guitar player were harmonizing together just like Dickie Betts and Dwayne Allman, which was just...
Oh, yeah, yeah,
I listened to it, and I'm like, wow, what does this sound like?
The influence, sure.
Oh, yeah. There's nothing like that when you have these sort of in-sync guitar lines. You can do it with piano, you could do it with other... But there's something about that electric guitar.
Exactly, yeah,
that's beautiful.
That kind of set the stage for that whole Southern rock, progressive Southern rock thing, you know.
You know, and I was curious about that, Bruce, because, you know, New England guy to the core, right?
Yeah.
When you started out of high school, what was the bug that you got, or did, or how did it, we talked about the Beatles when you were younger, and then the Southern rock thing, was it the guys that you started playing with as an influence together, or did you gravitate to Southern rock first? So how did that happen as a Northern guy?
I think I gravitated to Southern rock. I mean, Allman Brothers Live at the Fillmore East was really kind of the blueprint for me to learn blues rock with some jazz overtones, because the Allman Brothers really stretched the boundaries quite a bit. I got turned on to the Allman Brothers before I turned professional, and Skynyrd and, you know, Wet Willie and, you know, all the guys that were coming out of that scene. And then it was just a natural progression for when I put together my first band, Whitecap. Those influences were real strong. One of the guys in that band was a high school classmate of mine, Phil Nunez, and he stayed with me for 7 years. So we grew up together on that stuff. We wore out the 8-track tape for these Allman Brothers records, you know.
Right, right. Yeah,
8-track
cool.
tape, yeah. Can you believe it? Yeah.
They're going to come back like vinyl.
Yeah, I know.
That's what'll
That'd
happen.
Be great.
I was just in Burlington the other night, Burlington, Vermont, and they have this amazing vinyl store.
Yeah, I've been there. It's a great
vinyl. Did you go into that place?
I did, yeah. Actually, I went in right after you texted me saying that it existed.
Oh, it's amazing. You know, they have the old record players there, and they have the tape players, and it's all records.
Yeah,
it's got that smell, you know.
Oh, I love it. And the big album jackets with the big pictures. And, I miss that. You know, that
I'm huge into vinyl right now.
Yeah, my father used to tell me when I was growing up, he says, why is it that you can remember the credits of every rock album ever made, but you can't remember your multiplication tables? His theory was, he realized that you are going to do well with things that interest you. And I thought, music, man. He's right. He's right.
Well, there's math and music, so there you go.
Yeah, I know. That's the scary part.
Father's knows best.
You have a lot of vinyl? You listen to vinyl?
Oh, yeah, and I kept a lot of it when we moved. I got rid of a bunch of the stuff that I don't listen to as much now. Like, I had a big trove of Fusion, which I went through just a period of time where I was, like, buying Al Di Meola and Chick Corea and all that stuff and everything. So I got rid of those because I kept the ones I wanted, but I kept all the classic, you know, vinyl stuff from Santana to the Allman Brothers to everything, you know, I think it sounds better.
I
think they sound better. I guess because there's a touch of distortion in a vinyl record, that's very warm to the human ear. The problem with CDs is they're so stark and clean and they don't have any of that distortion that they actually kind of hurt at times. Vinyl is a lot warmer. It's like a Hammond B3 keyboard.
Nothing,
you know,
like the real thing.
Like when that growl comes in, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I went to this place in Watertown, and he's got floor-to-ceiling amps and turntables, and it goes from, like, the 40s to present day. And I bought a dual turntable. It's like a 1982 dual, and I got this amp. I can't remember the name of the amp, but it was 1979, and I got these old KLH speakers. And I think part of the reason why they sound so great is not even so much the vinyl, too, is that we're listening to our music through terrible... these little teeny speakers.
I know.
You know, like through my car, through
There's
my
no
iPhone,
bass, right?
You know, and now all of a sudden I'm listening to it in the original speakers that we were supposed to listen to it on, and it's so great. And I can't even turn it up that loud. I usually turn everything up really, really loud. If I turn it up too loud on my turntable, it's too loud for me. So, of course. And I'm hearing things that I haven't heard.
And isn't it frustrating the way today a lot of components don't even come with EQ? They don't think that the listener has the ability to set their own tone. That infuriates me.
Yeah. And the EQ is like, you know, you get your bass treble in the middle or something like that. That's all you get.
You got to be, it's very little tweaking.
You had the original turntable you had then, back then?
No, but I've got one that's 30 years old.
Yeah, well, that's...
Straight, it was called the Sony Straight Arm Tracking Turntable. It's a very, very cool piece of gear.
Excellent. And you wrote a song.
My favorite turntable is my Victrola, my 1926 RCA Victrola, which I still have. All my friends have given me all their old 78s because all the 78s that are in their attic, once they move or whatever, they got to come out and they're like, hey, Bruce Marshall's the only guy we know that plays these. I had to, after a while, say, friends,
please
no
stop.
More 78s. I will not be able to listen to them in my lifetime.
That's funny.
You wouldn't believe what you appreciate the record when you play it on a 78 wind-up phonograph or Victor talking machine that's technically known. You literally have to wind that thing 15 times. Yeah. You have to start the spin. You've got to clean the record, and you've got to insert a new needle every two plays. If you don't, the needle becomes a chisel, and it ruins your
records.
Really? But the good thing is the needles are $5 per hundred.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good.
On like online and stuff. Yeah. So, but you have to, they're very easy to do. But it's a process, and it takes about 2 or 3 minutes to set it up. And then you hope people listen because you're like, do you know what went into this?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I don't mean to spend most of our time talking about this, but that's the great thing about vinyl is that it's a process. It's you have to take the time to take it out, to put it down, to put the needle on. You can't just go and do whatever you need to do. You have to be present.
That's why the music needs to be good when you listen to it.
That's right.
Because if you listen to a crappy record, it's not worth it.
Right. Because if you sit down and pull out a newspaper to start reading, you got to get up 10 minutes later to go flip the album over. You can't.
Just go. It's very
iPhone.
Purposeful. You know.
Yeah.
You really have
I like
to
it.
Set
it's
out
very
to...
makes you very present. Which
yeah.
I,
yes.
Which
yes.
I like. So you know, you can see here. We've got a lot of notes on you.
Oh,
you know,
Jesus.
A lot of these. But there are certain things that we definitely wanted to bring.
I even
up.
Use a highlighter.
One of them.
First time.
Yeah. You use a highlighter?
Yeah, I did.
It's very studious.
It's very academic.
This was just a little teeny note in your bio, which I thought was really interesting. You played for Blue Man Group?
No, what it was, believe it or not, Blue Man Group opened for James Montgomery and I many years ago at the Hat Shell.
Oh, interesting.
Peter Frampton was the headliner. It was Peter Frampton, Montgomery and Marshall, and Blue Man Group. I think it might have been the only time they ever stepped out of that theater. And I knew very little bit about them. I just saw
these
three blue guys walk in the dressing room, and I went, okay, that's different.
They must be the Blue Man Group and not Peter Frampton.
Exactly.
Well, they're amazing percussionists.
Yeah, they're crazy good. I saw them in Vegas, and it was
oh, so they do take it. I didn't know they really took it on the road.
Yeah, used to be just Boston
much.
And New York.
On the other side of the spectrum, I wanted to ask you about opening for Ginger Baker.
Oh,
in
wow.
'83.
That was my second or third national act that I ever opened for. It was a little joint called Jonathan Swift's. It was certainly not the highlight of his career.
It was his trio, right?
Yeah, he had already done Ginger Baker Air Force, and he'd done a bunch of things. So he had a trio, and they were doing Cream songs and blues stuff. And it was funny, too, because it was at Jonathan Swift's, and I got the gig as a solo act. And I told the agent, I want to bring my bass player on as well. Mainly, he sings a lot of the harmonies, Phil Nunez. And they said, no, they're real strict. It's a small stage. They don't want to deal with it. So I actually had Phil sing the harmonies of the soundboard.
Oh, really?
On the soundboard.
The only time I ever did that. Yeah. I was just like kind of peeved that they wouldn't. So
interesting.
So I did the solo show. And it was great. You know, Ginger, he still had it, you know.
Did you get to talk to him at all?
Oh, big time. Yeah, backstage. Yeah. He was a little bit difficult at the end of the night because he didn't want to go out for his encore. So I remember my sound man was back there. He's going, come on, Ginger. These guys love you, man. Huh. You know, and so finally he went out, you know.
What an interesting guy. He lives in Africa now, I think.
Oh, does he?
Yeah. I mean, still around, still kicking. And he had, you know,
and the
issues.
Cream reunion in whenever that was, 05 or 06 or whatever, he was brilliant in that. He
That's
really,
right. That was,
he
yeah.
really got himself back in shape to do that, I think.
Yeah, you know? Interesting.
So that was that was a fun one. I think that was either the second or third national label.
Yeah, 83, I think
was. Okay, that sounds right.
Yeah.
Well, while we're talking about, when you look back, I know that you've had over a while, a very interesting career and worked with many people. When you look at that right now, what comes to mind as something that was really special for you as a musician?
Well,
I know there's got to be many, but...
Yeah. The first national show I ever did was at the Orpheum Theater in Boston, opening for Hot Tuna. Hmm. I found out about the show 2 days ahead of time. They didn't know they needed an opener. The agent was freaking out. And so somebody from Don, my guy that still works with Don Law today, called me and said, Bruce, can you do this show? You want to do, you know, it's the Orpheum Theater. Are you good with this? You know,
yeah.
I'm good with it, you know. So that was really cool. But and the funny aside to that was, so I did the show, opened for Ginger Baker, Cloud Nine, and then I drove across town and played Buzzy's Pub and Grub and Lynn in the same night. And so how do you sum up your career, Bruce? I'm the only musician in the history of music that has played the Orpheum Theater in Boston and Buzzy's Pub and Grub and Lynn in the same evening.
Right.
Okay, so that's it's really...
That's awesome.
It hasn't changed in 43 years. You know, I'll play with the Doobie Brothers and Huey Lewis, and then the next night I'm at a restaurant in Bellingham. You know, I mean, it's just it's the life of a blue collar musician.
Yeah, that's really wild, and it shows that it's really about, you know, another cliche. It's really about the music. It's about what you love to do.
Absolutely.
And you know, yeah, you got to make a living. You clearly, when you play and when you sing on stage, you know that you feel it and that you're... You know, no matter where you are, you're giving it 100%.
I like to think so. Yeah, I've had people tell me that. Hey,
yeah.
We saw you and there's only 8 people, you know, and you still put on a show, you know. That's always a nice feedback to get.
Yeah.
So you were in Whitecap, and what years were those?
Whitecap started rehearsing in 73, 1 year after I got out of high school, and we started gigging in 74. So we literally, for a whole year, 5 nights a week, we put that together. We were so new and so green, you know.
Yeah.
Unlike now, where it's hard to get guys together to rehearse.
Yes, it is.
So, and what was cool about that was there were a couple guys in the band that were a little more experienced, and they sensed that we had something really special. You know, we had a really raving guitar player in Phil Nunez. You know, I was the lead singer. We had a great rhythm section. And he said, guys, I want us to do this full time. And Doug and I, the drummer and the sax player, got together and they said, we're going to insist that this is a full-time band, okay? No day jobs, we're going to go for broke, you know? And at the time, I was selling shoes at Kennedy's department store. And we had just picked up a steady house gig out in Leominster, a place called Spencer's, and they gave us 3 weekends a month. And I did the math, and it turned out I was going to make $20 more a week playing music than I was selling shoes.
Perfect.
So,
no brainer.
Since that time, this is all I've done. I'm in my 43rd year of playing 250 shows a year on the average.
And you've never
taking more than 2 weeks a year off.
And you've never had an extraneous job?
I had my real estate license for a brief period. It was very part-time.
I heard you were really big into Christmas trees at some point. Heard that was the new and up-and-coming widget.
There's picture evidence of that, isn't there, on my website? Yes, it is true that a friend of mine in our neighborhood when we were very young got the idea that we would cut down small pine trees all around the neighborhood and sell them to the neighbors during Christmas.
Yeah, they were small.
As Christmas trees. And we underpriced the really nice fir Christmas trees, of course. The scam came to a halt when we realized we had sold a neighbor a tree that we had cut down in her yard.
Oh, well, yes.
She actually bought her own Christmas tree. So that didn't go over well. So.
Right.
I mean, we'll edit this one out so you don't get arrested for that, I guess. We won't let anybody know.
It could be a statue.
I like that. Yeah. So, okay, so you were in Whitecap, and when did Bruce Marshall and the Clue start?
Well, Whitecap lasted 7 years, okay. I'll just say that. And we played all, the full-time thing worked.
Yeah.
You know, we all did it. But we were mostly a cover band, so we didn't really have any original music to really break out of the cover band thing. But we did the ski areas in the winter and the beaches in the Cape in the summer. And we had a full-time manager and a box truck, and you know, we were doing it and we were living the dream, so we thought, you know.
Right.
You were.
Yeah. You're
living the dream.
Yeah, yeah. And then there were a couple of other bands that came after that. You know, I played with Mark Marquis. He's a great jazz guitar player. He's still out in the Leominster area. And I had a vocal band called Pizzazz with 3 lead singers, and that was really cool. Steve
That's cool.
Going was one of them. He's still a guy that's playing out in Worcester. Wilburn the Dukes is his band. But I didn't really get serious about writing songs till I put together Bruce Marshall and the Clue in 1983. Yeah, and that's when I, you know, I went out and bought a 4-track, and I sat down and I'm going to write 3 songs a week, and I actually did for a couple of years, and not many of them were good, but it was all, you know, a learning experience. And back then, I just like would write and write and write and write and throw stuff against the wall and see what sticks, you know. And now I try to craft songs and I try to come up with, you know.
Well, you know, it's because it's interesting because the 70s and 80s, I read this book and I mentioned it several times, and there's a book, there's only one book I could find that talks about Boston rock and roll history. And the biggest thing about Boston was Boston radio. That was like really the way, I mean, first, certainly the venues, you know, were a big part of it, but Boston radio getting onto BCN and all those radio stations were big. And it seems to be a lot of really seminal bands came out. What was that like? What was that time like for you, you know, starting out in that?
Oh, it was tremendous. It was very exciting for us. We were, you know, there was, like you said, there was a lot of bands were garnering interest, like the Cars and Jay Giles, and, you know, I mean, John Butcher got a record deal, you know.
John Butcher Axis, wasn't that what it was called?
Yeah, you know, yeah. I mean, a lot of some of our friends got signed. I had friends in the band New Man. They got a deal with Epic, you know. So everybody was like gung-ho to really try and get a record deal. We were young. We had the songs. So a lot of us, my band included, hired an entertainment attorney. And, you know, we tried to take all the steps. You know, we got our stuff out there and showcased it, only played original music for the most part. You know,
this was The Clue?
Yeah, Bruce Marshall and The Clue. And so that lasted a while. We put out vinyl. We were on five or six Boston compilation albums.
Yeah.
That actually is how we first got airplay.
I heard the one where you did the Boston Beatles cover.
Boston Does the Beatles. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I heard that was, I found it on the web. I found it.
Oh, did you really? Yeah, we did. We covered the song "You Can't Do That."
You can't. Yeah, uh-huh.
We had it. You know, we had like Barry Sax in it. We gave it like an R&B treatment. It was fun. Yeah. So you know, we did. Like I said, we did put out our own record. We worked our way up just like any band. We started playing Tuesday nights at Bunratty's, and within 5 years, we were headlining the Channel. You know, that's kind of how you had to do it. And Bunratty's and Harper's Ferry were really our home rooms, you know, that we always came back to. It was an amazing time. Everybody, you know, was so different because we were full-time players. This would be the scenario. We would go and play, let's say we go play Bunratty's. We play the gig, and then we'd always record every show, almost every show. The sax player lived three blocks away. We go back to his house, crack a few beers, put those tapes on, critique the whole show. And of course, we didn't stop playing until 1:45 in the morning. So by the time we got home, it was 4 or 5 in the morning. Well, nobody had to get up to go to work.
That's right.
We slept till 11, and then we got back to the club at noon and 1, and we rehearsed. Because back then, nightclubs didn't have to be restaurants. Music was so flourishing everywhere. You didn't have to sell food. You could be closed all day long and just play at night and practice in the day. And you know, these gigs were four, five, and six nights. Like the Bunratty's gig was 6 nights. Yeah. So they weren't open in the day. So the only people in the day were the janitor cleaning up, and we'd be in there, and we could use the house PA or our own PA if it was set up, and we would rehearse for hours. And then if we didn't play that night, we'd just go home. And if we played that night, we ended up doing rehearsal and playing. And what happened was when the drinking age went back to 21, we literally witnessed the business go down the tube. And I mean, we had a two-week stint at Bunratty's. We played the last week that the drinking age was 18 and the first week that the drinking age was 21. Best year of the club's existence, worst year of the club's existence. We watched it in 1 week go away. From that moment on, 5 and 6 night gigs. I shouldn't say maybe that moment, but within a year or two, 5 and 6 night gigs were history. Because think about it. You lost all the college kids.
Yeah, right. I was going to say, it took a while for the fake IDs.
You lost your 80% of your audience. So we had to adapt. We had to, and at that time, once the band I had at the time was called Fever, once that band broke up, I went acoustic. I got another guy, Jimmy Bruce, who was a great singer, guitar player, and we'd hit the college circuit and we got out of the full band thing for a while because it was all one-nighters. We didn't want to lug around a PA and lights, and we couldn't support that anymore.
Yeah.
So it was. We literally just watched it all. I think it was like 78 when that happened.
Wow.
I forget exactly. But
that's really interesting.
It was really it was heartbreaking.
What about what's going on now? Are you writing or?
Yeah, I always pretty much working on the next record. So I'm due. Our next record's going to be out next year. I'd say it's close to half done.
This would be the Bruce Marshall Group.
Bruce Marshall Group. Yeah, that's my main focus still. You know, we're still trying to expand our horizons and play in different areas and get as much of the original stuff on tape as we can. I also have a North Country band called the Nor'easters because I live in Maine now.
Oh, right, sure, yeah.
It's not always feasible for me to bring my Boston band up to the North Country. You know, I don't always want to come down to the southern part of New England, so I've got a group up there that's fairly busy, and we've kind of done a lot in the Lakes region of Winnipesaukee, North Conway, Portsmouth, Portland area, you know, Maine, that kind of thing. Still do tons of solo gigs. I make a pretty good living during the week, unlike a lot of players, because I have a lot of residencies as a open mic host and also, you know, solo dates. So I try to reserve weekends for band work as a rule. I mean, I mix it up. You know, it doesn't always work out that way. I like it when my guys actually are able to... They're not helpless if I don't keep them working constantly.
Mm-hmm.
My guys have other projects as well.
Yeah.
You know, I have my duo with James Montgomery. I have my solo gig. I've got two bands that are working now. You know, it's hard for me to keep any one person
busy
all the time, you know. So
you must be, so are you pretty organized with that, or do you have help?
Ron, I'm a musician. Did you say organized?
Yeah, but how do you, I mean, that's a lot of permutations.
That's why Michelle is here.
Right. I mean, you've been doing this a long time, so you know how to make it work, but you got a single, a double, you got a quartet, you got different bands, different playing in different places.
Yeah, I'm organized in a lot of aspects of it. You guys probably know that it's very difficult to get men of a certain age all together in a room to rehearse.
Yes, okay? We do now.
So we figured out ways around that, and we've done, you know, like when I create a tune, I'll literally sing it into my phone on voice memos. And I'll email everybody, what do you think? You know, worth working on? Yeah, David sends it back. Yeah, I got this guitar part, that guitar part. So anyway, we get all our stuff together by an exchange of material online, whether out of Dropbox or whatever it is.
Yeah, thank God for online, right?
You know, and the my guys are confident enough and good enough that...
They do their homework.
It comes together, man. I'll write a new tune, and the first time we'll play it is Friday night at Strange Brew to a full house, you know?
That's amazing. So that's when the technology works for you. You know, you may have the non-vinyl sound and, you know, all the other things about the modern technology and the little tiny speakers in your ear.
Right.
But that's pretty neat. You can just show up to a gig and say, well, this is our new tune.
Yeah, everybody got their parts. Everybody cool. If somebody says, you know, can we wait? You know, I'll say, oh, yeah, if we have to, you know. But so that's the thing. You know, musicians are notoriously... you know, the creative types are not always really on top of the business end of things.
Yeah.
I mean, I have enough ability in that regard to keep myself working.
Sure.
But do I have a good publishing deal right now? No, I don't. I have in the past, but I'm always looking at different revenue streams too. I you know, from selling CDs at gigs, doing my various acoustic and band gigs, plus this new program. Well, it's not new now, but it's called BMI Live.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a rabbit hole to go down when you start talking about BMI and ASCAP with people on both sides of the aisle. But BMI has created a program for working musicians that have original music and that are playing it in nightclubs.
Uh-huh.
You basically send BMI a playlist of everything you did on a particular night that you enter into the, and then you get paid for that.
Huh.
In other words, I have probably 75 songs that are licensed with BMI. They have to be licensed with BMI. You have to be a BMI member to use BMI Live.
Mm-hmm.
ASCAP has the same thing. I think it's called On Stage or something like that. A lot of guys don't know about it. Definitely a viable revenue stream. It's about $1 a song. Every time you play, let's say you play your original song in a typical nightclub in Greater Boston that does not have a cover charge, you get paid $1 to $1.25 every time you play that song.
That's
pretty
good.
Now,
if you play that same song opening for the Doobie Brothers at Hampton Beach Casino, which I've done many times, that pays $15.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay.
Right.
It goes by. It goes,
$15 a song.
Yes. It goes by capacity of the room. It goes by, is there a cover charge?
And it's all set.
Are there tickets?
There's a contract there.
Yeah. So when I do an opener for a national act, I actually make a little bit more money than I thought because I'm getting the BMI Live stuff.
And it's interesting because a lot of it seems, you know, from what I've read and what I've been seeing with musicians is that they make their money off of their CD sales that they sell themselves at their gigs, and they make their money playing live.
Playing live.
They don't play. They don't make their money online. You know, with Spotify
and
like
stuff
that.
Like no.
And that's why people just they gig and they. And they tour.
That's
and
the
they
only
that.
Sure. You hit the nail on the head. The only sure bet in the music business is a freaking gig.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to say it. I've been ripped off by club owners 4 times in 43 years. Mm. That's pretty good. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I've not gotten paid probably 3 or 4 times in 43 years. Mm. So that part of it is a sure bet. CD sales are up and down.
Yeah.
If I do a gig like a listening room, you know, which I love, like James Montgomery and I played the Mass Cove Art Gallery. It's this little place that, you know, 30 people, it's a sellout, but they just like hang on every note and
yeah,
buy
that's great.
Tons of product.
Yeah.
I you know, love that. So you come out of the gig and you're like, wow, I doubled my money, you know. Yeah.
How about a house concert? Do you ever do that?
Starting to.
Because that's the kind of a neat thing
I'm
to do.
I'm trying
and people
to
love
get
it
into that circuit, if you will. There's
yeah.
kind of a...
It's pretty hot now.
Yeah, it's really hot, and it's really, really fun to do. They're great. Obviously, you know, we're always, as original artists, we're always looking for, as my guitar player describes it, is the gig musical, okay? A gig with 8 TVs...
Oh, right.
And a Keno and a bunch of people chatting. That's not musical.
Yeah.
But sometimes you got to do it because yeah. you're a full-time player.
Yeah.
So that's code speak in our band. Oh, you're going to love this gig. It's so musical.
Interesting.
You know? And that
good
means
code word.
People
I like
are,
that. Yeah. People have to use that one.
People are hanging on every note and you know, they're clapping they kinda, in the, like yeah. a jazz crowd, you know, they're clapping in the middle of solos. Yeah. We live for that stuff.
Yeah.
You
right.
know? And we don't always
it's
get it.
It's a crazy idea. You know? It's a musical gig for a band. It's crazy.
It's like,
well, I always say it's a good listening room. That's, you know, people go there yeah. to listen. Like there's a place yeah. called Toad in Cambridge that people go there absolutely. and they listen. They're not there to they may converse a little bit, but it's small enough and they're looking at you and they're listening to what you're playing. One yeah. of the things we got our EP coming out. We want to play in a place where people are going to listen and not just us
chat,
be the background
chat.
Music.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and you know, another big change for you recently happened in that you moved out of Concord and now you live up in your winter wonderland that I know is a really yeah. important part of your life and what you like to do with, like, you know, being out in the snow and the snowmobiling and stuff like that. So that's really kind of changed, especially because now you have to do a lot of organization where you're
logistics.
Staying. And
oh, yeah, yeah.
How
yeah.
do you manage that?
Well, I've always wanted to get up there for years and years. Michelle and I just love, you know, the life up there and all the activities and everything. But we just weren't sure.
You're in Maine?
Yeah, in Denmark, Maine. We're okay. about 8 miles west of Sebago Lake. So we're in the Sebago Lake region. It's a really great tourist
yeah,
area.
It's great up there.
And, you know, we decided that the first year after we moved, that she would keep her part-time job in Lexington. It gave us health care. We wanted the dust to settle, you know,
yeah,
just
sure.
to see how it's all going to work out and everything. And so she quits her job in 2 days.
Yes,
it's
I heard.
It's been a
congratulations.
Year. And it's going to be great. We're going to definitely, we're not going to have to come down as much. I'm going to do my open mics every other week in Massachusetts. So Concord and Fireflies and Marlborough will be the first and third Tuesdays of the month.
Okay.
For now. And I've got others, you know, that are going to cover the ones that I can't do. So, and we're only 130 miles from Boston.
Well, Portland's such a great town for, I mean, it's really growing with all the restaurants there and the music. There's more
fantastic.
Music and... But Brandy Pond is up there. That's where
John Donahoe absolutely
does his summer gig, right?
Yeah,
which I've never been able to do. But
yeah, yeah, no, and he's done well. He's networked. Well, he's in Nashville.
He's
now.
He's in Nashville now, right?
But he comes up in the summer,
and he still plays with he's a member of the Bruce Marshall group.
He's not now. We will use him as a special guest, but we don't really have any avails. He's just not, you know, between
well,
he's what
down
he's doing
full time now. Yeah,
yeah, he'll fly up for certain gigs here and there, but no, we haven't done anything with him in a year, and we miss him, but. He made a good move for him, you know, being a fiddle player, sax player, mandolin player.
Yeah.
I found a lot of gigs. What's cool up there is that I've discovered it's a little bit, I'm kind of a big fish in a small pond there. You know, when you're in Boston, you're one in a million, you mm-hmm. know, when you're in this area. But I go up there and, you know, club owners are like, well, geez, you played with Toy Caldwell and you work with James Montgomery and... You'll play here, you know. Yeah,
yeah.
man. Yeah,
yeah.
You know, and so
I'll play here every Friday.
Exactly. Give me a residency. You know.
You know of the venue Blue
yes.
in Portland.
Yeah, we've been there once.
Have you? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we saw Britt Connors.
Britt plays there
yeah.
a lot, right?
We saw her
and
there,
that's yeah. a, such a neat place. And
I haven't been there, but
I'm really trying. Cool I'm trying to. There. That's a place that I want to try and get into.
It's a listening place.
Oh, I know and, it. Yeah, it really is.
I had another, you know, looking at some of these,
some of your
over
highlighted,
the career
highlighted notes
of Mr. Marshall. I, you know, you mentioned that someone mentioned that you've done voiceovers in the past.
Yes.
Is that something that, was this a brief part of your career or did you do it for a while? Or?
Kind of. I did a few things when I was in The Clue, just from being in studios and people, you know, engineers approaching me.
Like movies producers. Or something? Or?
No, or? Things like, you know, there was a Chamber of Commerce piece on Alaska.
Right,
and,
okay.
And they had me sing the theme song, you know, that kind of thing. And but my only tiny little bit of claim to fame with voiceovers is I was one of the main voices for W.B. Mason. Extra innings for about
for the Sox for about
4 years in a row.
When was that?
5 years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I probably heard it a billion times.
Well, that's the funny thing. You'd never recognize my voice because they not only the way they produced it and EQ'd it and everything, but while you were in there doing the thing, you know, they would say things like, you know, less stylistic. You know, more, you know, bland, you know, whatever it was.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know,
I'd
be at like, you know, in my parents' living room going, that's me singing right there. And they're like, no it isn't. That's funny. Not you. Yeah, it was a fun
that's
thing.
Cool.
You know, you had to really kind of remove yourself from the real creative aspect of the approach and just give the client what they want.
Right.
Yeah.
You know.
Have you ever been at any point a studio guitarist for people? Like, just be the hired gun.
You know, go in and play? You've got to be a really proficient reader. And again, I'm a guitar player.
Yeah,
so,
right.
You know.
But you're a good guitar player.
I don't mean to. You know the old joke. How do you get a guitar player to stop playing guitar? Put sheet music in front of him. You know? I'm that guy. What can I tell you?
I don't know what you mean by that.
You know, chord charts are fine. You know, but no, I've had other artists ask me to perform on their records, and that's really fun. And I'm comfortable with that. But I've never been a hired gun in the studio. That was something that I would have loved to have done had I gone to Berkeley.
Yeah,
I was going to go to Berkeley. Originally, my parents took me there. We did the interview, but right around that time, Whitecap formed.
Mm. Uh-huh.
So I had, on one hand, Berkeley working rock band, 18 years old, went with the rock band, you know,
and no shoes, no selling shoes, which no was shoes. A good thing.
Yeah, that's
exactly,
a big one.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, so that's it funny. Was, from that moment on, I had no more shoes. And
I had just two more things I wanted to say, and then we want you to play for us if you would.
Oh, I'd love to.
First was an awesome quote that you actually have on your website, where I think your manager called you and said, "Hi, Bruce, I thought I'd let you know that the Russians are now bootlegging your music and offering it as free downloads on the internet." That's pretty cool.
I forgot about that.
I like that.
You've arrived with that.
I'd be honored if my songs were being bootlegged by the Russians.
That was almost as proud a moment as when somebody called me and said, "Do you realize that your signature is for sale on eBay?"
Really?
And I said, that's what I said. I said, "Really?" And they said, "Well, don't get excited. It's a $3 buy it now, and it's been on there for 3 years."
Still, $3? I'll buy it. Is it still on there? I'll buy it. I'll buy it in your honor.
He will buy it, actually.
Imagine that.
And then the other thing
is, print it on a glass.
You also opened for the B-52s?
Yes.
What was that
yes.
like? Because that's a totally different crowd from your music.
That was wild. That was me and Dave Knoyer, my guitar player, doing a duo. A lot of these openers are...
When was it? Do you remember?
Yeah, it was 2005.
Okay, so fairly recently then.
2005, yeah. It was real fun. It was at the
Hampton
Casino, and they removed all the chairs and made it a dance party.
Oh, really?
So right off the bat, you just knew it was going to be.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a love shack right there.
Oh, they were so on. They had all the core band, the two girls, and Fred, you know, the guy that does all the singing with the girls.
The speaking stuff that he does. Yeah.
It was amazing.
Huh.
Great rhythm section. They sounded like a record, and they were super nice to us.
Yeah.
Like
they all seemed like really decent,
they came over to us
down-to-earth
and said,
people.
"Hey guys, great show."
Oh, great.
So you do that stuff, you're on cloud nine, you know, for a while. Then you go back to Buzzies.
Yeah.
What are you going
to
do?
Back to Buzzies. That's the next album right there.
That's a good album title, Back to Buzzies.
No. Or No More Shoes. I like that.
No More Shoes is good, too.
That is good, too. Yeah, yeah. That could be a good title for a song.
And the last thing I wanted to say to you is happy birthday.
Oh, thank you.
It's your birthday tomorrow, right?
Tomorrow, yes, thanks.
Huh? See?
Yeah, appreciate it.
Well, you know.
What's tomorrow? 27th.
27th, yeah. So luckily we got you right before.
Corndog Kelly is also celebrating the birthday. The banjo guy.
Corndog Kelly makes his own banjos.
You know him, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I remember he dropped his banjo on the floor and it broke in like several pieces. We're all like, oh no. And he's like, I can fix it. He made it. It's like, oh, no big deal. It's like, he's bummed, but it's like, I can fix this.
Really? Yeah. He's another guy that I kind of got to dust off the cobwebs and come out more. And
talented guy.
You know,
good woodworker.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Timmy and
Timmy too.
You guys, I love your band. I'm, you know, God, your vocals just.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, you're Your harmonies are just to die for.
If Ron shows up, we have good harmonies.
That's like the fourth. Yeah,
I just can compliment you.
Yeah, thanks. The third harmony.
You thought I was going to insult him, but I ain't complimented you. I could tell you were looking at me like I was going to insult you.
That is so cool that you guys formed from the open mic.
I think that's
how I met Dave. He came down as a solo.
And he did.
This guy's powerful. I love a guy that digs in and gets right on the mic and good pop. Writer, you know?
He is. He's episode 11. You'll be episode 12. So there you go.
How cool is that?
Yeah. You should have been before him, but we had to reschedule stuff. So I don't want his head to get so big that he thinks he's just because he's 11 that you're 12. Would you play a song for us?
Oh, I'd love to.
What are you going to play for us?
Okay. Well, you know, I know songwriters love to play their new stuff, but it's not always their best stuff.
Yes.
They're excited about it because it's new.
Sure.
Play a couple.
Well, this song is new.
Okay, great.
But I am excited about it.
So. Excellent. And before, as you're grabbing your guitar, people can go to brucemarshall.com.
That's right.
And you can get all your records there. And we always recommend people to buy the artifact, buy the physical CD.
Oh, thank you.
Certainly you can download it, but it's always best to purchase it. So,
yes.
Okay, so we're going to turn. What we usually do is we turn these.
Okay, so here we go. Smooth Ride Up with help from the Butler Frogs. How lucky am I? This is cool. From the time I was a young child, my folks instilled in me, follow your own path and the truth will set you free. So I started my own business and I took it on the road. It took off like crazy, but in the end it would explode. It was a smooth ride up and a hard road down. That's the way life seems to go. You know, that's always what I found. It's a smooth ride up and a hard road down. We climb so high and move too fast and run it all into the ground. It's a smooth ride up and a hard road down. When I let temptation grab a hold of me, I was fine on top of the world, it was all a fantasy. And I finally hit rock bottom, I felt like the walking dead. A homeless man living on the street, I said these words with dread. It was a smooth ride up and a hard road down. That's the way life seems to go, you know, that's always what I find. It's a smooth ride up and a hard road down. We climb so high and move too fast and run it all into the ground. It's a smooth ride up and a hard road down. You know, I've made mistakes. You know, I've been lost and found. I'm a lucky man. My friends never let me down. You know, I got no right complaining, cause I always turn it around. Well, I thought I'd found somebody to live out all my years. What started out so joyful, drowned in a sea of tears. When I finally found the courage to stand on my two feet, it always comes back to that phrase, I always will. It was a smooth ride up and a hard road down. That's the way life seems to go. You know, that's always what I found. It's a smooth ride up and a hard road down. We climb so high and move too fast and run it all into the ground. It's a smooth ride up and a hard road down.
Lovely.
Awesome. Oh, man.
Well, then we'll edit Ron's vocals out.
Yeah, just turn it right off.
The 1, 2, 1, 2, 3.
taking sides. I try to be honest and be fair. I got friends on both sides of the equation. That's a situation I can't win. When I offer my opinion, somebody's getting mad. I'm not one who's diplomatic, 'cause I've been hurt so bad. But I can't express my point of view. What's this poor old man to do? I'm caught in the middle.
Caught in the middle.
I'm caught in the middle.
Caught in the middle.
I should be a man and take a stand, but I need to think a little. I can't understand why I'm always caught in the middle. It happened when my neighbor left his wife. Half his friends just vanished from thin air. Well, you can't stop pitting one against the other. That's a sure way to lose both friends. Well, now I suggested closure, but he said, she said that. Now there's two grown people fighting over who should keep the cat. Here we go. But I can't express my point of view. What's this poor old man to do? I'm caught in the middle.
Caught in the middle.
I'm caught in the middle.
Caught in the middle.
I should be a man and take a stand, but I need to think a little. You can't understand why I'm always caught in the middle. I'm torn about my business, 'cause I ain't getting far. I'm torn about my taxes, I pay twice on my car. Well, I'm torn about where I reside, the city or the countryside. The folks I try to please, they're always taking this too far. Well, I can't express my point of view. What's this poor old man to do? I'm caught in the middle.
Caught in the middle.
I'm caught in the middle.
He's caught in the middle.
I should be a man and take a stand, but I need to think a little. I can't understand why I'm always caught in the middle.
Thank you, guys. That was fun. Appreciate it.
All right, I'm going to turn this off now.
At this point, everyone had to run home and watch the first presidential debates. So to ease the pain of that, we made Bruce play an extra song for us. So thanks to Bruce for the music and the conversation and for being such a great all-around guy. Check out where Bruce is playing and purchase his music directly on his website at brucemarshall.com. You can also purchase his music from all his bands on iTunes and CD Baby. Check out our own website at abovethebasement.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, listen and subscribe to our podcast, like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, and look at all the nice pictures we post on Instagram. We are everywhere. On behalf of Ronnie and myself, thanks for listening. Tell your friends. And remember, Boston music, like its history, is unique.